The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
This program. Today, the latest on healing. And yes, if you've been taking watermelon juice, you were doing the right thing, but I'll explain why. Also, we're going to talk about the omega-3 fatty acids and hawthorn berries in our introduction. A lot on the environment today because there's a lot of important things happening, and our issue of the day will also be environmental. It's from Chip Ward of Tom Dispatch, and it's Someone Got Rich and Someone Got Sick. Nature is the 99% too. Very interesting commentary, and I'll share it with you and then get your input. Also today, brand new information for all those in the environmental movement and the autism movement, the vaccine movement. Newly exposed documents show that a major study of autism and mercury that confirmed the two was intentionally hidden, withdrawn by the CDC. So I'll get into that because we're on top of the vaccine issue in a substantial way. My guest in the second part of the program is Colin Woodard. And Colin is an award-winning investigative journalist. He is an author who has conducted research and reporting in over 50 countries, primarily Eastern Europe and the Balkans. He's currently the foreign correspondent for the Chronicle of Higher Education, the Christian Science Monitor. He's received a lot of awards, the Jane Bagley Lehman Award for environmental issues. I'm going to talk with Colin today about the fact that we are not one nation. We have never been one nation. This is a myth. And also, I think it's absolutely supercilious. It's just ridiculous to talk about blue states and red states. There are no such things as blue and red states. This is a myth. But we do have many nations, as in M-I-N-I, many little nations. How many? We'll start with 11. And then once we discuss this in depth, you'll understand how these 11 rival regional cultures of North America shape who we are today. It'll be an interesting discussion of history and the United States. Now, I've been telling you for some time now that we had better pay attention to the oceans rising. And the oceans are rising because of all the new water going in, because the accelerated melting was getting really bad. But I also said that in some areas of the world, the water is rising not just because of fresh new glacier water, but because of tectonic plate shift. In effect, the whole ocean bed in the southeast Pacific is rising. When that happens, the water rises with it. And with that, you have ever-increasing high tides. I said that about 150 million people would be immediately affected. It's worse. Today, two reports. One from Bangkok. Bangkok is sinking. The floods are not caused by rain. Also in Vietnam. Same thing there. Now, I'm posting these on my website so you can actually see people by the thousands wading through the streets, not because of monsoons, not because of rain, but because of high tide. Whole cities are being affected. That also means water sources, crops, because the water coming in is not fresh water. It is seawater, polluting wells permanently. So it's happening, and it's happening now, not in the future. So two parts of the world we're going to explore and show you what I saw. And I remember seeing it for the first time running up the beach from the end of South Beach for 10 miles. I was on a 10-mile run up, 10-mile run back, 20-mile run. And I saw, and I remember things that stick out to me, that seaweed was on the base of swimming pools, on the walls. Now, then later, when I would ask people, I said, have you noticed any difference in the tides? Oh, yeah, they're coming in further and further. Now they're getting right up on those walls. Big problem for the whole coast of the United States. So anyhow, that will be in depth. So we have a lot to share with you, including, if time permits, corporate crime in the cereal aisle, how companies are fooling you into thinking their products are healthy when they're not, and also nuclear pollution of the sea from Fukushima that we haven't seen a thing on the United States. Well, according to France's nuclear monitor, quote, the cesium-137 that leaked into the Pacific from the Fukushima disaster was, quote, the greatest single nuclear contamination of the sea ever seen in history. But weren't we told that that wasn't a problem? Oh, yeah. This is typical of the people that run the Japanese government. They said not a problem, and that was mirrored in the United States, because it was iodine-131 they were measuring. All right. What's the difference between iodine-131? Well, it'll go into the sea, and it's a result of the Fukushima disaster, but it decays rather quickly. Its half-life is 8 days. Hence, quote, it's swiftly diminished. So all the reports, don't worry about the sea vegetables and the fish. Eat those, because the sesame is iodine is gone, the 131, in 8 days. That's not the big one. The big one is the most deadly, and that is the cesium-137. Half-life of the 137, 30 years. That means it'll take 60 years to get it out of the water. So they didn't. Why didn't they mention that the really bad one that takes a long time to decay and is heavy, heavy in sea vegetables and fish... is going to be around for most people's active adult lives? Well, because that would affect commerce. You wouldn't be buying their seaweed or their fish or their tuna. So that's the latest. And again, we haven't seen that in the United States, but that had to come from Paris. Now let's begin with the latest on health and healing. Oh, one other thing. We have arranged two of the single most important programs for those of you who care about environmental issues for this Monday night and the following Monday night. Now, this may run a little long because this coming Monday night we're doing a special progressive commentary hour on gas hydrofracking. We'll be having Al Appleton, the former New York City Commissioner for the Department of Environmental Protection and a former Director of New York City Water and Sewage System, Professor Tony Engrafea, head of Cornell University's fracking group, Craig Michaels from the National Resource Defense Council, David Braun, who was one of the people who spoke at our demonstration recently, and he is the person who is part of the Oil and Gas Accountability Project at Earthworks, and other guests as well. So it'll be the definitive radio program on gas hydrofracking and why it's dangerous. Particularly important in New York State that you listen to it and then let your legislators know. We have all the evidence they have not talked about why gas hydrofracking is wrong. That is Monday night, 7 p.m., only over the Internet on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com, Progressive Commentary Hour. Now, the following Monday, we will have a full 1 to 2 hour special on the dangers of genetically engineered food. We will have Jeffrey Smith, Dr. Doug Gurian Sherman from the Union of Concerned Scientists, Dr. Michael Hansen from the Center for Food Safety, Professor Don Huber at Purdue University, who did the cutting-edge research on genetically modified organisms and why they're dangerous. So we will have the leading voices in the world on genetic engineering, and hopefully Vandana Shiva, who's going to try to put it into her schedule. So back-to-back, two progressive commentary hours, Monday this week, Monday the following week, on gas hydrofracking and then genetic engineering. By the way, that hour, that one single hour a week, is the most downloaded internet radio program in America, Progressive Commentary Hour. And you can go to the archives if you want to hear this past Mondays. Let's begin. We all want to prevent osteoporosis and osteoarthritis and We want to have good, strong bones, but we also want to have healthy tissue around those bones. Well, one nutrient helps with both. From the journal Osteoarthritis and Cartilage, University of Bristol School of Veterinary Sciences came up with the study that showed that the omega-3 fatty acids prevents osteoarthritis. Quote, omega-3 fish oils could substantially and significantly reduce the signs and symptoms of osteoarthritis and slow its progression. That also means it turns off inflammation, which could help to get better mineralization into your bones. So I'm suggesting either from vegan sources, the type I use, or from fish that you have it twice a day. Once in the morning, I'm going to suggest for those of you who already have arthritis and you haven't had relief, I'm going to give you a little different protocol. So please try this for 1 week. If you have arthritis anywhere in your body, and if you're still having pain and loss of motion and stiffness, try 2 tablespoons of emulsified cod liver oil on an empty stomach upon arising in the morning, and then follow that an hour later with 1,000 milligrams of buffered vitamin C and cat's claw. All right? See the difference in 1 week. Let me know, please. Hawthorn berry improves cardiovascular function. This is from Dr. David Jockers. Good information over at Natural News, so thanks for doing all your good reports. He's found some work that shows that hawthorn berry, which, by the way, historically comes in a little jar, and you take about 20 drops and then just let that sit under your tongue for about 20 seconds, then swallow it down. Very good for flu season and cold season. But the hawthorn berry comes from trees, tree plants in the rose family, that are native to the temperate zones of Europe and the Middle East and Asia and North America. And in fact, in the Middle East, it's actually considered a sacred plant. Now, this medicinal herb is known to be one of the greatest natural agents for improving cardiovascular function. It's amazing how many people I counsel who've been to holistic doctors for their heart conditions. The doctors never recommended hawthorn. I don't know why. It's the German government, it's a Commission E, endorses hawthorn for cardiovascular disease, and the studies on hawthorn under natural therapies are impressive. It improves circulation, it treats angina, it lowers high blood pressure, it reduces cardiac arrhythmias, and it helps alleviate congestive heart failure. Well, that's the full spectrum right there. And it's renowned for its ability to strengthen the heart and blood vessels and to restore healthy muscular tone to the heart wall. So everyone over the age of 50, just as a matter of strengthening your heart, should take 20 drops or a teaspoon. You can't overdo it, but 20 drops or a teaspoon of hawthorn liquid each morning. It's loaded with all kinds of antioxidants and phytonutrients. It has tannins and flavonoids and proanthocyanins and phenolic acids, all of which are really good for you. So, for those of you who know anyone who have bad hearts, who especially congestive heart failure, I'm suggesting that there are at least 6 studies I know of that hawthorn berry, taken generally at 900 milligrams a day. But I'm going to go higher than that. I would go probably twice that. So let's have healthy hearts. And it contains flavones. And we know that the flavones enhance the function of certain cardiac enzymes. And this effect increases the heart's contractile force, which effectively boosts the stroke volume while increasing the heart's tolerance for different conditions. It improves the heart's ability to create energy through anaerobic metabolism. So it's just good all the way around. So just make sure you're getting your hawthorn berry. Now, I mentioned at the beginning watermelon. Now, first, I love watermelon. I mean, I It's one of the treats I have. Wherever I can pick up an organic watermelon, I do. And if it's not certified organic, which sometimes they're not, I just find one that they haven't used pesticides. The largest farmer's market in America is in Dallas. It's a wonderful farmer's market. It's about the size of 6 football fields. And 4 of them are covered, and you drive through them. And every 10 feet, you'll find another stall. And everything you could ever imagine that could be grown, they grow. And when I speak with the people, most of them are very small farmers, got an acre, 2 acres, 3 acres. A, they can't afford pesticides, and B, they don't want to use them. And they bring their stuff in every day. It's open every day of the year. And there, they can't afford, it's very expensive to become a certified organic farmer. I know. I am a certified organic farmer. It costs thousands and thousands of dollars, which is very unfair for someone who can't afford it. And so what you do is you get something that is called transitional, which means it's not sprayed, so it is organic, but it's not certified. And as long as you know the people that you're getting it from, it's fine. Anyhow, I always take watermelons. I load them up in a cooler when I drive. And just nothing more refreshing than some cold watermelon. Now, of course, juicing watermelon is also good. Each morning when I'm in New York City, I go up and I get a big watermelon juice. It's 32 ounces of watermelon juice. But also I put the juice of 4 whole lemons in it. And when I say whole, I mean the whole skin, everything goes in, seeds. Because a lot of the nutrient value is in the oil and the seeds. And then I spike it sometimes with vitamin C and some other nutrients. But it's delicious. And then I will freeze those watermelon cubes made with lemon juice and then throw the frozen watermelon lemon juice cubes in a blender and add in a little bit of cherry concentrate and make a slush, like a snow cone. Really good when you finished a hot workout. Well, there's another reason to drink watermelon juice or eat watermelon. It comes from the University of Kentucky. They did a study and they found that watermelon reduces atherosclerosis in mammals or animals, and it was the juice of the watermelon that did it. So, quote, here's from the study. Melons have many health benefits. This is Dr. Shea. This pilot study has found 3 interesting health benefits in the model of atherosclerosis. Oh, good. It's good for humans as well. One other thing that's good for humans, the B complex, and a B derivative helps diabetics with mild kidney disease. This is from the American Society of Nephrology. So this is the main orthodox body overseeing kidney disease. It is a simple nutrient. It's a B6 derivative called pyridorin, P-Y-R-I-D-O-R-I-N. And it helps slow or prevent the progression of mild kidney disease to with diabetes, and it protects your kidneys. So let people know that a vitamin B6 derivative can help slow or prevent the progression of mild kidney disease in patients with diabetes. Finally, 7 billion people are not the issue. Human development is what counts. This is from the Institute of Applied Systems Analysis, and I'll quote this. It says, as the global media speculate on the number of people likely to inhabit the planet, an international team of population and development experts argue that it is not simply the number of people that matters, but far more important is the distribution by age, education, health status, and location that is more relevant to local and global sustainability. Any realistic attempt to achieve sustainable development must focus primarily on the human well-being and be founded on an understanding of the inherent differences in people in terms of their differential impact on the environment and their vulnerabilities. These vulnerabilities are often closely associated with age, gender, lack of education, and poverty. And so what they're saying here is that in a society such as ours, we invest nothing in the human capital to help protect the environment and make it sustainable. All we do is exploit it. We're in more primitive societies where they have less formal education. They live closer to the land, and they must understand cycles of nature. If they're living in balance, they can sustain themselves. If they're living out of balance, they can't. And so they're asking don't just think about reducing the population. Stop this massive urban sprawl. Stop using things that are finite that you can't just use forever and throw away. And that's important. Now, that leads me to this. This is a report from Chip Ward, and this lead into our next segment. I'll quote this. It says, "Nature is the 99% too. What if rising sea levels are yet another measure of inequality? What if the degradation of our planet's life support systems, its atmosphere, oceans, and biosphere, go hand in hand with the accumulation of wealth, power, and control by that corrupt and greedy 1% we're hearing about from Zuccotti Park? What if the assault on America's middle class and the assault on the environment are one and the same? Money rules. It's not hard for me to understand how environmental equality and economic inequality came to be joined at the hip. In all my years as a grassroots organizer dealing with the tragic impact of degraded environments on public health, it was always the same. Someone got rich and someone got sick. In the struggles that I was involved in to curb polluters and safeguard public health, those who wanted curbs, accountability, and precautions were always outspent several times over by those who wanted no restrictions on their affluence. We dug into our own pockets for POSI's money. They had expense accounts. We made flyers to slip under the windshield wipers of parked cars. They bought ads on television. We took time off from jobs to visit legislators, only to discover that they had gone to lunch with full-time lobbyists. Naturally, the barons of the chemical nuclear industries don't live next to the radioactive or toxic waste dumps that their corporations create. On the other hand, impoverished black and brown people often do live near such ecological sacrifice zones because they can afford better. Similarly, the gated communities of the hyper-wealthy are not built next to cesspool rivers or skylines filled with fuming smokestacks. But the slums of the planet are. Don't think, though, that it's just a matter of property values or scenery. It's about health. It's about whether your kids have lead or dioxins running through their veins. It's a simple formula. In fact, wealth disparities become health disparities. And here's another formula. When there's money to be made, both workers and the environment are expendable. Just as jobs migrate if labor can be had cheaper overseas, I know workers who were tossed aside when they became ill from the foul air or poisonous chemicals they encountered on the job. The fact is, we won't free ourselves from a dysfunctional and unfair economic order until we begin to see ourselves as commodities, communities, not commodities. That is one clear message from Zuccotti Park. Polluters routinely walk away from the ground they poison and expect taxpayers to clean up after them. By externalizing such costs, profits are increased. Examples of land abuse and abandonment are too legion to list, but most of us can refer to a familiar Superfund site in our own backyard. Clearly, Mother Nature is among the disenfranchised, exploited, and struggling. The 99% pay for wealth disparity with lost jobs, foreclosed homes, weakened pensions, and slashed services. But nature pays too. In the world the 1%ers have created, the needs for whole ecosystems are as easy to disregard as, say, the need the young have for debt-free educations and meaningful jobs. Extreme disparity and deep inequality generate a double standard with profound consequences. If you're a CEO who skims millions of dollars off other people's labor, it's called a bonus. If you're a flood victim who breaks into a sporting goods store to grab a life jacket, it's called looting. If you lose your job and fall behind on your mortgage, you get evicted. If you're a bank or broker who designed flawed mortgages that caused a million people to lose their homes, you get a second home vacation mansion near a golf course. If you drag heavy fishnets across the ocean floor and pulverize an entire ecosystem, ending thousands of years of dynamic evolution and depriving future generations of a healthy ocean, it's called free enterprise. But if, like Tim DeChristopher, you disrupt an auction of public land to oil and gas companies, it's called a crime and you get 2 years in jail. In campaigns to make polluting corporations accountable, my Utah neighbors and I learned the simple truth. Decisions about what to allow into the air we breathe, the water we drink, and the food we eat are soon enough translated into flesh and blood, bone and nerve, and daily experience. So it's crucial that those decisions involving environmental quality and public health are made openly, inclusively, and accountably. That's Democracy 101. And that's from him. I'd like your thoughts. Call us at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. Now, just two additional thoughts I have on this. And this comes from personal experience. When I was told that the Tea Party were all a bunch of racist redneck idiots and they were a danger, the very first Tea Party groups I went to see who they were, and I found that with a few nut jobs, the rest were very normal type of people. Some were Democrats, some were Republican. Many were against war. All were against the Federal Reserve. Most came from Ron Paul's initial forays into challenging the causes of our economic problems at the Federal Reserve. Then, so I saw that what was being said on television by Keith Olbermann and others was not from their own first-hand personal experience. They hadn't actually gone out to these rallies. So they were making assumptions and painting everyone with the same brush. And I thought, that's very unfair. We shouldn't do that. It shouldn't be about good and evil. It shouldn't be black and white. Life isn't that way. And yet that's what was happening. And I saw this polarization and, once again, conflict. When I heard about people being poor just 2 days ago, I found a minister from a regular church who had been arrested, and all the other people from local churches were told they would be arrested if they ever dared again give free food to homeless people in a city park, in a little area that the church, as you will see from my interview, because I filmed it, they would go in, the people were very orderly, including a lot of family with children, and they would come, they would get a meal, they would leave, and the church and their volunteer parishioners would clean up. No crime, no mess, nothing. And yet the neighbors around that park and said, we don't want these homeless people in our park. And so now the sheriff and the county have said it's a crime to help the poor in public. It doesn't matter where it's at, you'll be arrested. And these were church leaders. I mean, mainstream churches, Catholic priests, told, you step foot in that park and you give a homeless person anything, you're under arrest. Real story. Hard to believe, but I'm their first person. That's why I'm on this trip, taking time to spend whole days with people to see what their lives are like. Here's something for you. What would you think about going into the woods and you see children playing? What you don't see are adults. And then you see children going from camp to camp trying to find food. Do you realize that they're now homeless children in the woods? They're homeless children with parents and they have no food. They literally don't have anything more than the clothes on their back. So you talk about something that will give you a little wake-up call about our compassion, our uniqueness, our giving. It's the 1% causing these problems. The 99%, we're great. No, you're not. So let's get over this 99.1, because it's not just about economics. It's everywhere I'm going in America, every state, every county, every city, everywhere I'm going. Remember, unless you've traveled my shoes, unless you've been where I've been, and I'd like to see you do it, then you won't know the truth of what's going on right in front of us, but it doesn't get any attention. So I'm seeing people in New Jersey, for example, in a place where there's 63 people in tents, where the county comes in and tears down any tent that could actually hold a fire, or a stove, with winter coming. No electricity, no water, and yet it's a neat camp, it's clean, there's no debris. A minister donates his time to go there and actually lives in a little school bus that I filmed. And not a penny from anyone, but who wants them out of there? The local middle-class people. How many shelters are there in this county with 600,000 people? How about zero? So there's no services, but we don't want you here if you're poor. Everywhere I'm going, I'm finding this to be true. In California, where people used to be out in Long Beach and near the beach, now they're told, get out of here. But we're not doing anything. It's just safer here near the beach, and we can go in the ocean and take a shower underneath one of those faucets. Nope, no you can't. A homeless vet, I just filmed him. And there were hundreds of homeless vets standing around listening to this being filmed because I was the only filmer allowed in. Why was I allowed in? Because I'm actually doing things to help them, taking tons of food to them. Where the other journalists go in for a second and they're out of there. They don't care about these people. And this guy says, I'm a homeless vet. I've been homeless for 9 months. I was in the military for 18 years. And I went to a veterans park to read. And I'm sitting in the park for about 2 minutes. Cops come up and said, leave the park. Guy said, why? It's a veterans park. I'm a veteran. Said, are you homeless? Guy said, yes. And you're a vet? Yes. Then you're not allowed in the park. You're not allowed in any park. You're not allowed to sit on any bench. You'll be arrested and put in jail for 2 months to 3 months. Why? What crime did they commit? They're just poor and they're vets. So at a time when Sean Hannity is leading his charge around the United States for veterans, why is the suffering of 900,000 homeless vets and suffering from alcohol, drug addiction, post-traumatic stress disorder, sexual abuse, why is that not even a talking point? Why is that being negated? Well, I want to tell you, Sean, Bill O'Reilly, Glenn Beck, Laura Ingraham, and Ann Coulter, Michael Savage, Mark Levin, why don't you come to any of the stand downs where there are hundreds of homeless vets, 16,000 in Florida alone, and ask them what they think of you? Because they told me, and well, you'll see it soon enough on camera. So there's just utter hypocrisy out here. Who's polluting the environment? Is it the 1% who are doing all the polluting? How about standing up against the war? Who's standing up against the war? Who's standing up against civil rights and women's rights? And who's standing up to clean up our environment? Who's standing up for the health of our children? Before we get too self-righteous in this 99-1, take an honest look in the mirror and ask yourself, what have you done to make it a better world? And what have you done to pollute that world? What have you done to eat the fish out of that ocean without concern of how that fish was caught? What have you done when you eat food not realizing that food is genetically engineered? What do we do to contribute to the destruction of the planet, our health, our societies? Because there's some incentive other than a spiritual one. Those are my thoughts. I'd like to hear from you. 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888. That's our number. And sorry I'm on the air. There might be a little static when I'm traveling like this. We're going to go to a break and come right back with your calls.
You know I can't be found sitting home all alone. If you can't come around, at least please tell the phone. Don't be cruel to who heart is true. Baby, if I made you mad for something I might have said, please don't forget my past. The future looks bright ahead. But don't be cruel to who heart is true. I don't want no other love. Baby, it's just you I'm thinking of.
I'd like to hear your thoughts. Let's say hello to Donald from New Jersey. Hi, Donald. Donald, you're on the air. Please speak up.
New religion. You know, it's praised in the media all the time about its saving grace of profit and growth, you know?
I'm sorry, you're coming in and out. Please call back and we'll put you right up. I can't hear what you're saying. Let's say hello to Pam from New Jersey. Hi, Pam, you're on the air.
Hi, Gary. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hello?
I can hear you fine, Pam.
Okay. If all the nuclear plants melted down from the solar flare and the grid shutting down, would anywhere in the U.S. be safe, like Colorado or New Mexico where they don't have a nuclear plant, even if the wind blew the radiation, would it blow the radiation over?
Well, yes. There are places that would still be able to be safer habitats. If you go up on my website, I list a 37-page getting off the grid with maps, and the maps also contain all the nuclear power plants and the highest level of gas hydrofracking, and it shows you where at least would be safer to live. But the Northeast United States and Midwest would not be a part of that. Okay? Let's say hello to, once again, do we have Donald back on? All right, if not, he's welcome to call back on. Let's say hello to Elizabeth in the studio before we go to our guest. Hi, Elizabeth.
Good afternoon, Gary. Yes, we have something here from Susan. She's from Maryland. She works in social services.
Speak up, I can't hear you.
Ah, here we are, sorry. She works in social services. She's very supportive of the Wall Street movement. She has been. But after spending 3 straight weekends there, she says that they've not, in her opinion, had a very constructive impact. She sees a lot of young people that are very focused on themselves, and they're really quite angry, and they have an aversion to authority. But she was part of the civil rights movement. And she would like to see them learning from lessons of the past, but she thinks that they're disinclined to do that. And she was also at your speech in Washington about freedom of choice, and she'd like to know what your thoughts are on this. Do you think this is a fair assessment?
Depends upon who you speak with. There's not one voice, and therefore it is not fair to say that there is any single dynamic at play, except that people are angry for different reasons, and that's legitimate, and they're coming out and speaking out, and that's what we've been asking them to do for a long time, especially this younger generation, which they haven't. For an entire generation, they've been absent. And in fact, I have a whole new book on this. Why were they absent? Why are they lost? And understand how few of the over 40 million actually are showing up, less than 0.01%. So it's not like there's a major movement. We have to keep things in perspective. If you don't look at something authentically and honestly, and you get caught up into these mass overstatements or gross dismissal of truth, then you learn nothing. What is important now is that those who are showing up are at least expressing something that all the rest of us who are activists or conscious have been stating all along. But we also see that just showing up in and of itself is not and should not be the point. Whether someone has food or shelter, whether someone gets hit in the head or not, should not be the focus. What should be the focus is trying to get an agreement on some unifying theme of change. Getting out of Afghanistan, closing down military bases, closing down the Federal Reserve, stopping bailouts to banks, all the things that should be done. But there are about 100 different things that should be done, and unless you put a lot of focus and lobbying and education behind that and unifying people, it won't be done. But in America, we do something that's unique and different. Like, our youth cannot be compared to the youth in other countries, because our youth, though they are in debt, understand in other countries, they're not in debt because they went out to a mall and spent too much, or they went to a private school, or they maxed out a credit card or got loans. They're in debt because they've been living in poverty for sometimes their entire life under social systems that didn't allow them the freedom to express themselves, such as the Middle East. So theirs is a far deeper sense of frustration, and they're going to have to go through 2 or 3 subsequent revolutions before they finally have something resembling a democratic process. I mean, getting rid of Mubarak was good, but the permanent bureaucracy has taken its place is not going to change. So if they can coalesce into something like the civil rights movement or the feminist movement or any of the great movements, then they will have some measurable success. If the idea is that there's just going to be this group here of 100 and this 50 and this group here and this group here, it'll rise, it'll exponentially expand, and then it will collapse, and nothing will come from it. And you can't have something that general, that vague, cause actual change. If you want real change, Every single person in America who's frustrated and angry, take your money out of their 20 top banks. Disinvest yourself. Stop eating their food, wearing their clothes. Stop buying their home. Stop getting mortgages. This is the wrong time for anybody to buying anything that they don't absolutely essentially need. So once you do that, then you affect them and you impact them in a way that otherwise they wouldn't be paying attention to. But if it's just a group of people who are saying, we're disagreeing with you, you know, you're greedy, you have too much wealth, fine. But that doesn't actually change anything. And change has to come through actions, and those have to be specific, and they have to be based upon a unifying theme. And if there's one thing this generation has, it's a sense of such autonomy that they just don't feel comfortable surrendering any of their own personal views to one focus that may not be in alignment with them. So it's up to them whether or not they're going to succeed or fail. But if they think the American public is going to accept this indefinitely, within 6 weeks from now, there'll be a blowback if there's not some real constructive insight with specific people coming forward to saying, here's what we're asking the American people to consider that would make this a better place, more equitable place. Let's stop all private financing for any election. All right, that would be a great place to start, because then you're getting rid of the lobbyists, you're getting rid of the Supreme Court's giving the right to buy an office to whoever can afford it. But if you don't do that, then nothing changes. Politicians are still going to give you whatever you want to hear, but behind the scenes, they're accepting the money from the special interest groups that allow them to continue benefiting the corporations that continue to reap this enormous reward.
Right.
Get together and say trading into commodities essential life. No more trading in water, no privatization of water, electricity, coal, food, gas. So if you get them out of the business, if you get Wall Street out of the business of making money off money and exploiting people, then they might actually invest in re-establishing new infrastructure in America. Otherwise, even right now, yesterday, Wall Street went up 300 and some points. Why? Because they said, oh, Greece is safe. Greece is not safe. The bankers investing in Greece were made whole, but Greece is going to go down in flames. But more importantly, where did this 3.5% increase in gross domestic product come from? Profits in the financial sector and people spending money on their credit cards. Well, hold on. If you buy something on your credit card, that's not, say, a disposable income. You're now in debt. So we cannot make debt an asset. It's not. Because everything you bought with that debt is going to devalue, whether it's clothes, cars, or anything else, immediately. So we're not looking at the fact that we are a house of cards. Hope that answers your question.
All right. Can I just ask, is it naive to think that even the way they're actually protesting, the way that they're sort of, you know, there's verbal abuse on both sides, police and protesters, that that alone is a sort of a violence in a sense? Should they be doing that, or should they be coming from a more...
Hold on. Let's understand that I believe that a lot of agent provocateurs are in all these demonstrations. And I believe the vast majority of people are truly pacifistic and are nonviolent. And I believe that there is a need for this kind of bleeding in order to keep it so that you can create a reaction in the right wing saying, see, these are irresponsible people. They're a danger to our society. Crack down. I don't believe that a lot of this was accidental, and I don't believe a lot of it was just students are reacting. They've been extraordinarily passive.
Mm.
And so I think look for the agent provocateurs. But I also believe that it would be constructive if they just simply invited leading people from Wall Street down and had roundtable discussions, but done so in a diplomatic and polite manner. Tell people your grievances, then ask people on Wall Street to respond to them. What are you going to do about it? You have to have, at some point, you have to have a dialogue. Mm-hmm. If there's no dialogue, there's not going to be any change on anyone's side. And right now, there's no dialogue.
That's great. Thank you.
Okay.
Very much.
All right, we're going to go to our guest in a moment. Just this on the environment, which I'm very concerned about. And I'll get to the autism on our next program. This is from Bangkok, and I'll quote this. Bangkok is sinking. Floods are not caused by rains. I'll quote this. This is Bangkok, the capital of Thailand, and a gem of Southeast Asia, is sinking due to the most serious flood in the last 50 years. Most of the city's 50 districts are expected to be flooded in the next 3 days. The peak of the flood is forecast for Sunday. But that time, by the time the water level in the river will exceed the critical point by a substantial margin. Then it goes on to talk about the high tide coming in. Now, the high tide has nothing to do with this. So on the one hand, they've got floods, but on the other hand, they've got floods are not caused by rain in this case. Rain will continue, but they're saying that what is happening, massive soil erosion, irrigation systems flooded, because the high tide is coming in at greater than ever before, sometimes 200 and 300 feet inland, covering up whole streets, and you can see this up there for yourself. That's that high tide I was talking about. Same thing is going on in Vietnam as well. Back in a moment with our guests. Please stay with us.
Well, since my baby left me, well, I found a new place to dwell. Well, it's down at the end of Lonely Street, that heartbreak hotel where I'll be just a lonely baby. Well, I'm so lonely, I'll be just a lonely, I could die. Although it's always crowded, you still can find some room for broken-hearted lovers to cry there in the gloom.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. And I'm just going to ask my engineer if my guest is on board. Do we have Colin Woodard on board?
I believe I am.
Hi, Colin. Thank you.
How do you do?
I'm very good. I gave your introduction a little earlier. Let me just tell people that Colin is an award-winning investigative journalist and author. And he's written several books. The latest is American Nation, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures of North America. Colin, instead of looking at the individual 50 states making up the U.S., and this, instead of saying we have blue states and red states, which I think are nonsense, take us through the tradition of American historical study that focuses on regions or blocks within the U.S. that have their own distinct historical roots that give rise to their unique culture and ethical values and result in the kind of relationships that people have with government and what they expect from government. And since we may not be able to go through all 11, do the ones that are most important for us today.
Well, the central argument and what I'm trying to demonstrate to people is that the real cultural fissures in our country don't respect state boundaries or indeed international ones and bleed over into our neighboring Canada and Mexico, and that indeed the actual cultures all stem out of we've had these divisions and differences between them since the times of Jamestown and Plymouth, the original colonial clusters on the eastern and southern rims of what's now our country. Each of these clusters of colonies was founded by very separate groups of people who had their own ethnographic and religious and makeup and entirely separate political goals and ideals and founding intents, as it were. And those they developed in remarkable isolation from one another, and to a great degree through into the first quarter of the 19th century, spread westward in largely exclusive bands, sort of putting the cultural DNA of their dominant cultures and their ideals and practices and expectations and fundamental values into effect for the rest of us to encounter as we move to those places. And it's this this original founding fathers, you know, that in times of polarization and national division, Americans often try to look back to the founding fathers of 1776 and 1789 to, you know, try to understand, if we could just understand their intent and their fundamental values, and we could get back to a shared sense of purpose and unity. But that's frustrated by the fact that those men were not the founding fathers, but rather the grandchildren or great-great-great-grandchildren or great-great-great-grandchildren of the actual founders of these original colonial clusters and the countries, really, that they produced. So this plays out in considerable extent in understanding our history, and you see if you know where the cultural divisions lie and the actual, if you have that new map in mind, you can see it played out in the alliances it formed from conflicts in the English Civil War with different nations, as it were, different countries taking different sides through the American Revolution and the War of 1812, and indeed in detailed geography of understanding the alignments leading up to the U.S. Civil War. And as you ask about, it does extend right through to politics today, where you can see it played out on the county level, blue county, red county maps of many of our hotly contested elections in history, including the recent ones. Would you like sort of an outline of some of the big players? As you say, there are 11, it's too much to talk about all at once.
But. Well, just take maybe one from each area, like the South, because there's a unique culture in the South that many people don't understand. And the same is true from the Pacific Northwest.
Absolutely. I mean, the two superpowers of our history, as it were, amongst these regional cultures that have been fighting it out in most of the internal conflicts we've had throughout our history and continue to today, are the ones that I call Yankeedom, which is the greater New England cultural space, and the Deep South. Yankeedom includes, as you might imagine, New England itself, but also extends out over the upper tier of Ohio and on into many of the upper Great Lakes states. And it was founded by the early Puritans on the shores of Massachusetts Bay, and they were coming, these people, with a very specific goal in mind. They were trying to recreate a utopian society on the Calvinist model. They were going to create a new Zion, a light on the hill for the rest of humanity to observe. They were trying to create, as they understood it, a more godly society here on earth. And they were going to do it through, you know, public institutions, essentially, that that you would be able to socially engineer a better and more godly society through public institutions. And the key thing which matters today about that experiment was that what really, really mattered was the freedom of the community, right down to the town meeting sort of level, not the freedom of the individual. Is the common good and community good, even if it required individual self-denial and self-sacrifice. And think about it, what are more Yankee and New England stereotypes and that sort of stern self-denial aspect. Now, many of the other regional cultures look upon that as strange and indeed un-American. Now, you couldn't get a more different place, initial settlement group and leadership group from Greater New England than the people who founded the Deep South, this is the really Deep South. This is South Carolina and the coastal plains of the Gulf states extending all the way down into eastern Texas and up the Mississippi Valley towards Memphis. And this was a culture created a couple of generations after the Massachusetts Bay Colony by English slave lords from the island of Barbados, who came to Charleston and founded what became South Carolina, and it's a culture that extended onwards. And it was, from the beginning, they were transplanting a fully formed West Indies-style slave society. And this was modeled, it was a republic modeled on the republicanism of the ancient world, in ancient Greece and Rome, which were societies where a small oligarchy had and practiced the privilege of democracy, and slavery was the natural and indeed thought as naturally born lot of the many. It was, they would argue, many of their intellectuals and political leaders right up through into the 1860s, that a republic could only survive on those kind of terms. So it was a society that, from the beginning, tolerated enormous disparities in power and didn't have a lot of emphasis on equality and little or no emphasis on public participation in politics. In fact, quite the reverse, an actual discouragement of it. And that society was essentially created to serve the interests of the oligarchy, not the other way around. Now, both of these societies, Yankeedom and the Deep South, have, of course, changed a great deal in the past 300 to 400 years. But one of the many fundamental things that has not changed is that very strong difference in emphasis between whether freedom is about the community's freedom and therefore having to put blocks and checks on individuals lest they become tyrants, or whether freedom is about individual freedom. In the Deep Southern case, that the powerful should be free to continue conducting their affairs and and be free of impediments. So you end up with two very different policy solutions that are indeed reflected often in the politicians that each region produces and their political agendas. And I should put a quick caveat in there. I'm not talking about individuals. I mean, individuals who live in Yankeedom or the Deep South or in the Midlands or any of these other places have the entire diversity of opinions, of course. And you can see that in the way people vote and how many people vote for the candidate who loses. But what I'm saying is these are the dominant cultural frameworks we've been left with that we encounter as individuals, and we may find them frustrating, or we may think they're great, but they're there as sort of a fact on the ground that has to be contended with, whether we like them or not, in each of these regions. And the assumptions and underlying cultural emphases are quite different from place to place. More different, I would argue, than the differences between any two member states of the European Union.
I appreciate that. Thank you. During the GOP presidential debates, we had heard some extremely unusual statements and crowd responses from the GOP voters. For example, the crowd cheered when Ron Paul affirmed an uninsured man should be allowed to die, or Rick Perry comparing homosexuality to alcoholism and stating that the federal government has no role in educating children. And then, of course, Michelle Bachmann, who can share the belief that if we remove minimum wage, we would wipe out unemployment. And there are many more of these kinds of ideas floating amongst all the GOP contenders. However, for a typical New Englander or person from a Yankeedom background or from the left West Coast, these are perceived as loony. On the other hand, wanting a strong union presence in the country where universal health coverage or more regulation on banks and corporations polluting the environment are seen as equally loony by staunch Republicans and many libertarians and Tea Partiers, which I would guess make up mostly the region you call Tidewater in Deep South and Greater Appalachia. So the question is whether it is even possible for there to be agreement between some of these regional ideologies, and if that is true, is the idea of the U.S. as a unified union a myth?
Well, what you point out, there are stark regional bases for those two broad policy positions you describe, and you correctly describe them to the regions where they receive the most strength and buttressing from the dominant culture. I mean, the Greater Appalachian idea, you know, this was a region founded by frontiersmen descended from Scots-Irish and Ulster Scots and people from the English borderlands who had lived in a war-torn region where you couldn't count on outside authority to protect you, and you had to do it yourself and protect your own and your kin, and had similar experiences on the frontier here, and it was a culture that emphasizes individual freedom and personal liberty before all, meaning there should be as few encumbrances as possible on each individual person's freedom to do whatever. And that's a very different idea, as you point out, than the Yankee dominant tradition of having to put some impediments on individual behavior so they don't emerge and become tyrants lording over everybody else. So, yeah, you see those strong regional differences. Now, there has not always been exactly the same coalition as we have now. The Dixie, sort of the deep southern-led red coalition of the past few decades, which does include Greater Appalachia and the sort of Chesapeake Tidewater zone of that came out of early Virginia and the deep south, as I've described, and currently the weaker partner being the interior west, which I call the far west. That's pitted up against the Yankee coalition, which is the Pacific coastal strip from just north of Monterey up to Juneau, Alaska, which has been long the Yankees' great ally regionally, and the area around the Big Apple, New York City, the Dutch-founded area, which has many Dutch precedents and is called New Netherland. And those two coalitions face off against each other now, but those are not the coalitions through history. So, I mean, these things, yes, to try to broker a compromise between the individual freedom and the protection of communal freedom and common good is one of the great American arguments. But not always have the strong political coalitions on a regional basis boiled down to those particular points. I mean, the far west, the interior west, has a strong stress on individual freedoms and liberties, but it's also a region that has been aggrieved by, throughout its history, having been treated as an internal resource colony by the rest of us and by the federal government. And there's this sort of colonial resentment of the outsiders for this intrusion. Now, you could, it used to be before World War II that far westerners were most motivated to resist their corporate masters who were, had headquarters far outside the region, the sort of anaconda copper-like entities that dictated life and owned the politicians, and there was a great populist movement in much of the interior West. Today, though, the emphasis is on the intrusion and anger towards the federal government, which still controls much of the land there, and indeed, you know, runs and sometimes sets terms on the use of the massive capital infrastructure projects that make many aspects of far western life possible. So that as long as the emphasis is now on the federal government as the worst oppressor, they are able to form a successful political coalition with deep southerners. Even though, and like greater Appalachians, a sense of individual freedom comes up against the idea that the, you know, societies should be organized around the needs of the oligarchy. Those are contradictory ideas. So what I'm saying in this long-winded way is that the there are many aspects to what these different nations consider important, and they have to broker compromises and coalitions, and over time they sometimes shift. So what seems like, on the question on certain questions that this will be immutable and never change, there's actually wedge issues within these coalitions that can that could rearrange the map and therefore rearrange broader electoral politics and the balance of power as to who has the upper hand in controlling the levers of our federation's government and therefore the political soul of the nation. So in broader historical terms, I don't despair that it's possible for there to be realignments because other issues and things are play in what are, in essence, big tent coalitions.
Well, Colin, I thank you very much for doing this. Very important book, American Nations, A History of the 11 Rival Regional Cultures, which today very few people understand that much of what they're believing today or accepting today was passed down generation after generation based upon the very earliest of the colonies and people who were here long before, hundreds of years before the Revolutionary War and the Constitution, which for a lot of people is where they think history begins in the United States. It does not. And coming from Appalachia, I can tell you there's a very unique culture in Appalachia. And I was a part of that. I saw it. But also living in New York City, I saw a different culture. And visiting as I do all over the United States, I see the cultures dictating so much what people will accept or reject, even if it goes against common sense and reason at times. So I appreciate this overview. It's certainly something to give us something to think about. So Colin Woodard, thank you very much.
Thanks much for having me. Enjoyed it.
I'm Gary Knoll, and one of the things we do here on the Progressive Radio Network, which has been in existence for 7 years and is the fastest growing internet radio system in the world, is we try to unify. We bring people together from every kind of background and just ask them one question. Can you empower people in a constructive, positive way so that their life and everyone else's life is made better and the environment too? And that's why you hear Danny Schechter and so many other really unique minds. So we're happy to be bringing some people together. I'm Gary Knoll, and for those of you listening over Progressive Radio Network, we thank you. Sunday night, 8 o'clock, All About Health and Nutrition for 1 hour, and Monday night, the Progressive Commentary Hour. You won't want to miss that. For those of you listening over BAI, back in a moment. Please stay with us.
Well, bless my soul, what's wrong with me? I'm itching like a man on a fuzzy tree. My friends say I'm acting wild as a bug.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matthew Bogart. All shows are archived by Kyle Pollard. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Jason Tappenfeld.
My knees are weak. I can't seem to stand on my own.